Our mother's organs and that organ's brother are being interviewed by Renee Garrowin for Concord Oral History. The interview is taking place on December 10, 1998. Leonard is 66 years old. Nat is 72. Naturally, the first question I would like to ask you is how one brother's name is Orkin and the other Arkin.
Well, this is Len Orkin responding to your question. It's good speculation, but it is speculation. Hold on. My father was somewhat cavalier when it came to names. And in point of fact, my brother's birth certificate is Arkin, my birth certificate is Orkin, and our older sister's birth certificate is also Orkin. His citizenship papers, I think, were Orkin, his union papers were Arkin, or vice versa. My guess is that the true name is, when spelled in Yiddish, using Hebrew characters, would use an aleph, the letter A, but the sound of it is determined by the vowel sign that goes underneath it. As once written by my father for me, the underlying vowel sound makes it sound Orkin as opposed to Arkin, but the letter A remains the letter A, so probably we should all be Arkins, but we ain't.
Now, your family, your father immigrated here, and actually is considered one of the first Jewish families that we have records about. Can you tell me about your parents and where they immigrated from, their name and so forth?
My father immigrated from, as a matter of fact, both my parents came from the same small town in Russia. And I can't give you the spelling, but it's pronounced Lusk.
And probably spelled G-L-U-S-K.
And it's approximately 50 miles south of Kiev. That's the name of our name. My father came here as a teenager, and somewhere around 1960. We're not exactly sure. He came into Boston. The reason he came into Boston was that his sister had seen him in the United States. He was living in Garden, Massachusetts with her husband and family. So that became the logical connection with the place where my father
lived. He lived in Gardner for a brief period of time, worked with his brother-in-law who had a haberdashery. As was the norm at the time in those early years, there were tailor shops all over New England, and they were generally operated by Jews. And as quickly happened, my Aunt Freda, heard of a tailor shop in Keene, New Hampshire, in which the local tailor had died. And what do you do? Well, you send up a Jew to pick it up. And so my father had to hide himself off between New Hampshire, I believe, or Wolf Bar, New Hampshire, I'm not sure which, and began and opened up, picked up the tailor shop. Spoke no English, literally no English, he said. And as he pointed out, he said, one day people would come in, bring their clothes, explain what they wanted to do. He would smile as knowingly as he could. They suspected he didn't understand a word they said, and they'd take the clothes and walk out. And he said that the turning point came when an English teacher at a local high school brought her clothes in and explained to him what she wanted to do, what she wanted him to do. He again did his usual shuffle, and she said, "You don't understand a word I'm saying, but I'm going to teach you." And then she came in for the next few weeks and taught him English, rudimentary English. And he said that she saved his life. Thereafter, he was able to practice. He then moved. You want the whole story? You really want the story how he came to Concord?
Yes, how he came to Concord, yes.
Sketchily, he felt terrible as he lived in New Hampshire. He felt physically awful. One day he went to the doctor and explained his terrible feelings. The doctor suggested that he go to a nearby city where they had ladies who could fix his problem. And my father was absolutely scandalized by the thought. And in which case the doctor said, well, then I think you better go someplace where you can find a girl and get married. And so my father went to his sister and explained the problem, and she said, well, you're going to go to New York, because that's where all the people from the Shtetl went. And so my father hied himself off to New York. And when he came to New York, he, the first thing he did is you found your Hebrew man, someone fixed him up to the girl. And he said, it was a blind date, and he showed up at her door, and she came to the door, and he said he fell in love.
That was your mother.
And
tell me what your parents' name
was. Her name was Rose Kaplan, and his was either Sam Orkin or Sam Arkin, as the case may be.
And in the different parts of his life, he was multiple.
Tell me about
Rose
where you lived in
Concord. Well, initially when we arrived, I believe that was in 1937. The first place we moved into was a house on Hubbard Street. At that time, it was 44 Hubbard Street. It was a house we rented. My recollection is we were only there for 3 or 4 years. After that,
I know we were there through 38, because the hurricane took place there.
Yeah, I remember that clearly, too. In fact, I have a scar on my leg. Anyway, after 3 or 4 years on Cover Street, we purchased a home on Main Street. At that time, it was 113 Main Street, the last house on the left, going toward West Concord, where we came from the about 13.
Now it's 441. I checked the house right across from the South Bridge Hotel.
Oh.
Very close to the railroad track.
It sure was,
yes.
So the rumblings of the train were part of your life, then?
I'll never forget having guests staying overnight in our home and having a train come through, especially during the war. Some of those trains were literally a mile long. The house would shake. They would think the house, the train was coming through the house. And we were always surprised because we'd become so used to it, we didn't even notice that the train had come by.
Today, the skilled tailor making dresses, suits, and so forth is passing. We don't see that as part of our daily lives anymore. But tell me about your father's work as a tailor.
Well, my father was a very skilled craftsman. He had worked in New York as a tailor, obviously, trained as a tailor in Europe. And after a strike, the serious, hard to believe that my father was involved in the strike, but anyhow, it appears that at the end of the strike, he was not invited back. And that's when he went back to New England, where his brother had set up a tailor shop in Concord. His name was Max Arkin, and they became partners for a brief period of time. My father was a skilled craftsman and well regarded by the ladies in Concord because he turned out one of the suits conservative from a sartorial point of view. They liked his kind of clothing, which was very, very conservative and very well made, very beautifully constructed. I can't imagine how many after he moved away, when he died, the letters came from people in Concord praising his skills as a tailor. And also, hard to believe, him also as a fashion consultant, so many women really relied upon his good judgment and taste. We always thought he was pretty nuts. But in any event, they thought otherwise. And he was a well, well loved person.
Give you an example of how skilled women come from Boston. Pages they had taken out of magazines for the dress and the suit and asked my father to reproduce it. somebody who was aware of this ability recommended it to the Red Army School of Design, where they offered him a position in the pattern to make
the teach pattern.
And he turned it down. And I really think the main reason is he didn't think his English was good enough. And so he was dead wrong on that. More than adequate for that.
I wish it still were around today. There was a friend of mine, a woman who grew up in Concord, now in her 50s, still has a skirt, a wool skirt that your father had for her. He would not cut the hem on it because he told her that the wool was too good on the skirt. She wanted it, she was a 60-year-old girl then, wanted it above her knees, and he would not cut it. He gave her an overly long hem because he knew at some point of her life she would take that hem down, and she did, and she told me that Sam Market knew better.
Oh yeah, sure did.
Tell you just a little family story with humorous. Woman brought in a coat, which she apparently purchased a rabbit coat somewhere. She brought it to my father to modify it somewhere. She asked me, she said, Mr. Arthur, you're going to have to fight. Wear this fur coat and it rains. And my father's response was, lady, did you ever see a rabbit walking through the woods with an umbrella?
That was very good. Tell me where his shop was.
Do you know where Henry Dane's law office is?
Yes.
Right there.
Yes. Okay. And I guess Rich's drugstore used to be...
It was downstairs. Yep.
And who was your uncle's store?
Well, Vanderhoof's hardware store.
I see. Okay. Your family has one of the first Jewish families. I've read in one history book, I guess, Scudder's Concord American Town, he actually makes the statement that he knew if it was a Jewish holiday that the tail was closed.
That's true. That's true. I was sort of, you know, just, they didn't know much about Jews. And because of that, when we were, we did not go to the school on the high holidays, we had to bring in a note to our parents. And when I came to law school in New York, I'd gone to Harvard, but when I came to law school in New York, in Columbia, and on the first Rosh Hashanah after I got to New York, I walked out on Broadway and saw nobody was working in a place that was thick with human beings going to temple. I was astounded. I did not realize. I mean, I intellectually knew, but never really realized how many Jews there were in the world.
Can you comment on, you know, what it's like to be such a small percentage of the population?
My own experience is that in terms of anti-Semitism, I encountered it really when my life was rather small enough. And it was entirely when I was pretty young, when we were relatively new in Concord, and typically it was from kids about my age. I definitely do not have any feeling experiencing ongoing anti-Semitism in the town. I felt that by and large I was accepted in every aspect of the town that I care to participate
in. I would echo that. Obviously I was younger than my brother, so all of my years were spent in Congress. And occasionally somebody would, you know, talk about the Christ jump in case of me. I remember once a fellow named California was his first name, who was really taunting me, and I was really not much of a fighter. And one of my little friends, a kid named Frank Ford, his father had been a runner for the IRA, said, "How dare you do that to my friend?" And wailed into him and beat the hell out of him for picking on me. I have very little anti-Semitism. I would have to add to that, I was a very social person, and there was always a girl in my life, regular. And I, in retrospect, think back of how many fathers' hearts must have fallen to their feet when I arrived at the front door to take out their precious daughter. But I have to say that if I was ever refused a date, they sure as hell have hid it from me, and I never thought of it as in any way being
a
human.
Was there a feeling, not of anti-Semitism, but like a curiosity that, you know, about the difference, or was it of knowing, a little interest?
I think it was a very little interest. Remember, anti-Semitism doesn't, I don't think, has much of a chance when you have a town that is, that has a history like Concord, which is sort of open to new ideas. There was an alcohol bar. Number one. Number two, when you're talking about five human beings in the whole bloody town, it's not a threat anymore. And so we were just sort of an oddity, which Concord sort of, I think, kind of would pride itself in having a few oddities here and there. We were one of them, I guess.
Yeah, but in terms of being curious about us, I don't recall a lot of questions. Occasionally, as we came to a holiday or approached a holiday, somebody would ask us to explain what was the basis for this particular holiday. But generally speaking, I don't recall a lot of questions about the nature of our religion.
But I'll have to add one more part about that, which I think is sort of indicative of fun. My freshman year in high school, homeroom teacher named Jack Dunham, who made better became principal. In those days, you will recall, you started the day with a prayer and a reading from the Bible, locally well as the Sleeping Flag. And here I was, a kid in high school, and Jack Dunham, first day, took me aside to Lynn, in order to make it more comfortable, we will only read from the Old Testament this year. And I thought that was a very sensitive thing to do.
Yes, that's extraordinary. Are there other Jewish families that you remember?
There were really living in Concord only one other Jewish family. Well, I think only one. My brother held up two fingers. I think only one. I don't think Max lived in Concord anymore.
Oh, I thought he lived over there.
No. They lived out in a family of families.
But at one point they did have a guest.
Right. And the other one was the Jacobs. Mrs. Jacobs.
Yeah, Jacobs. I'm not sure.
Jacobs. And Mrs. Jacobs lived there. Mrs. Jacobs, who was her daughter, Dorothy Jacobs, and Heidi was her son. She ran a little, kind of a small truck farm that had a stand out on Sudbury Road, wasn't it?
No. Thoreau, maybe?
Maybe Thoreau Street, getting out toward Walden's Lawn. And I think her husband had been the tailor in Concord before Max came.
Yeah.
And he died, and I think Max was like 10.
Yeah.
And she lived for a few years when I was a little kid. I would go there Sunday sometimes to visit. But then she died, and what happened to her?
Also, to the best of my knowledge, when I was in high school, I was the only Jewish student at the school.
Me too. Since we weren't there at the same time, you know.
Yeah,
that was it.
I was 2 years.
And my sister was also, you know.
She is 4 years older than I am.
I see. Your father went to an interview with your sister. He mentioned that, you know, how some people were very nice to him. The priest invited him to the dance, but one of the things that he wanted was a place of his own. Today there is the synagogue, Karen Shalom, in Concord. But then, where did your father and his family go?
On the high holidays, we went to Maynard. There was a little Orthodox synagogue in Maynard, in which, after you got to be 13, on Yom Kippur, if somebody had to go to the bathroom, you'd have to count heads to make sure that he still had a minion. and if I wanted to go out and play with my friends for a while, you'd have to count heads and make sure you still have a midget. Having said that, we would also occasionally, my father, in a fit of desire for really classy stuff, would take us to Boston for the high holidays, where we would hear a real cancer carrying on. Excuse me, but essentially a major, and essentially only the high holidays. Although my father was then rather kosher, kept a kosher home as long as they were in Concord, I would not say my father was going to do this thing. That was the only time we went to Haas to the service.
Of course, the fact that, you know, the closest synagogue is 7 miles away, most of the time, it was colder.
Certainly, when they retired with Florida, he became very much involved with synagogue place today.
I enjoyed when he recognized that when the Republican man, he registered Republican, but once he decided to hold, he chose a Democrat.
Yeah, let me give you a little background on that. Initially, when he arrived, he registered Democrats because his party affiliation was happening. Of course, both my parents were close off on the water. And the custom in Concord was that when you came to vote, somebody would shout out your name and your party affiliation. So the first time you voted in Concord, everybody preceding you was John Doe Republican. Then they came to Sam Martin Democrat. Apparently the place went silent, everybody stared at him, and he was embarrassed. So he decided he would register Republican and vote Democrat.
He was a pragmatic man.
Correct.
Absolutely true.
He was in a very skilled occupation. But there were other occupations then that you don't see now. Town is largely professional, like engineers, lawyers. Then he had other occupations. They were chauffeurs, they were cooks, they were laundresses. It was a different type of town then.
That's correct. Well, we had a mix. Certainly, there at that time, there were bankers, there were lawyers, there were people who owned stores and the proprietors of the stores, and then there were the blue-collar workers that you just described.
Do you remember any of the other shops or any of the sites and sounds of the town that you share with us?
Well, I can start off and then jump in. I clearly remember Pritchard's Drugstore, which was sort of a hub for young people. We went to Minnesota with also, my father, whose shop was in the middle of Richards, but there were two other places right there. He also occupied that space. One was Fred T. Boyd, who was a real cook. The other was John Brooks, who was a barber. As a matter of fact, John Brooks' son, Bobby Brooks, was friend as a kid. Another place that we used to pick up was the Vanderbilt's hardware store. That was where you went to do stuff to work on your housework. Peterson's clothing store was another place that we picked up. And one of my classmates was the son of the grandson of the founder of Peterson's clothing store, and I think I can give you his name. The place we shot generally was the Economy, which was on Walden Street, just about opposite where the Anderson Photo Shop now is. I used to hang out a great deal with the folks biking. When you were in Kennedy?
Yeah, there was. Well, I was there last summer, and I was surprised to see that Mary Curtis is still there. Right next to where Mary Curtis was, no, right next to it, I guess, was a fruit store, which my parents referred to as the Greeks. And they, it was the only place in town to get nice fruit and vegetables. There was a cobbler, I remember. Look, when we grew up, the town had to service people in their regular, ordinary way of life. The people who commuted to Boston were a minority, and the town itself was basically self-functioning.
By the way, speaking of Boston, I mentioned that on homeless culture. In the early years, that required my mother going to Boston. Every week, and come back with a
Let me correct that a little bit. She would go in maybe like once a month. She would call on a weekly basis. The butcher would pack her order in dry ice and put it on the train. Tell the train at the time she would take the train and take stuff home. But it was very difficult to do because she maintained a kosher house and all the music.
But fruit and things like that.
That was easy. That was local.
Sure. There were greater class distinctions than today. One of the areas responsible for opening up opportunities was certainly public education. Can you just overall describe your school experience?
I arrived in Boston when I was 11. So I started off at the junior high level and continued through the public system until I graduated in high school. The first school was the Peter Gault Lehman School. Then we went on to the high school, which was on the same street as Peter Gault Lehman.
I think it's the,
Stone Street,
and COW.
Yes,
so
right.
That's it. And we had the gym across the street, Peter Buckley. We had a shop building, which was somewhere between Peter Buckley and the high school, on the same piece of land as the high school. And of course, the playground was still there. Athletics. When I graduated from high school in 1943, almost everyone in the class was directly, both males and men, directly in the service of age. I was 17 when I graduated. I enlisted at that point, and I went to active duty a year later.
What was the impact of the war just growing up during that time period?
From my point of view, it was pervasive. Every day, you know, you look at the newspaper and see where the troops were. And I lived through the agony of the early part of the war and the triumphs of the latter part of the war. After 43 and 44, then I knew where my brother was. My sister was all in the Navy. She was stationed, of course, only in the U.S. I don't know if the Navy could. Women out of the 48 states. And I knew where my brother was all this time, and I sort of had a map of the war, or I charted the war. But it was sort of a part of your everyday life. All pervasive, but no more so than the weather. And it was there, and you lived with it. Virtually every house in town had the blue, or God help forbid, a gold star in the window, which indicated that people off to war. It was the last, quote, good war, close quote. And no dissent about it. Everyone knew it was the right thing to do. And it's pervasive, but simply a part of the thing that you go through every day.
I have a memory of gas shortage, gas leak shortages. Everybody who had a car or a truck had a ration stamp of some kind. As a matter of fact, at one point, I worked in a printing company in Waltham where we produced ration stamps. This is what I think was some of the information. I remember there were certain foods that became short. Butter disappeared and was replaced by margarine. Built into the plastic that the margarine was in, break the coloring, and then knead it until it was useful. You would color it uniformly.
That was a job that Matt and I had. We throw it back and forth as a football because it was in a plastic, one of them was in a plastic bag. Remember? We throw it back and forth as a football until it got the right color.
Silk, of course, disappeared during that period. I think there was a pervasive feeling of patriotism.
Absolutely.
Everybody felt that the war was the right thing and supported it.
Yeah, but you were a spotter then.
Yeah, that was another thing that I did in high school. Somebody decided that that there was a threat from German airplanes to the east coast of the United States. And they established spotting towers throughout along the east coast. And one encampment was at the top of the Shattuck Hill. And they built a tower there.
So I was one of the volunteers, and one night a week, one of the adult volunteers would pick me up by car and take along a thermos of coffee or whatever, and spend several hours up on the tower. Never saw a thing.
But there was a camaraderie, Matt, among all the spotters.
Yeah, very definitely. And there was just in general throughout the town during the war. There
sure.
was a united feeling about, you know, this is something that should be done and we're pulling together.
I don't think I have ever seen or we will ever see anything like it again in our lifetime. We may never, ever, ever see it again in this country. I think Vietnam and its brethren were too destructive.
Yes. This past weekend, they did a rededication of the war memorial of World War II, and then the Korean and Vietnam name also on there. They have pushed it back from the street, and it was very, very moving. And an F-18 did a flyover of a band plane. It brought people out. Almost
to
the spirit
they described. Yeah, but it's maybe it's a small town down there, maybe living in New York, it's different. I don't know. I do remember VE Day though. Jesus, what a day.
You were in Concord?
Yeah, in Concord. Everybody went downtown. I mean, you know, we lived a mile out of town, we walked downtown. And cars with tooting their horns, people loaded with people, just snake back and forth and back and forth. Nothing, you know, not like there was any speeches or anything, just pure, glorious joy at the end of this awful thing. And everybody was there.
Renee, you asked before, and I don't think I responded, you asked about friends. My closest friend, buddy, growing up in Concord, was Chuck Locker, Charles Hubert Locker, Jr. I was also, another friend was Bob Brooks. But McPhillips, John McPhillips, who lived behind us, who lived on Harper Street, and John Dunn, who was our neighbor, his father was a chauffeur for, I believe, one of the buses.
Well, if you're interested, my best friends were Johnny Russell, his father was a veterinarian in town, Frank Clarkson, his father worked with rubber, and Hal Pratt, his father kind of sold real estate. Those are my three best friends in high school. And for many, many years, I used to see them once or twice a year, but I guess I had it now for about 5 or 6 years or more. but Johnny lives over in Reading, I think, Hal, I mean, I think, I don't know, I've lost track of Hal, and Frank lives in Cape Ann, around there someplace.
But your 50th reunion will be coming up now.
Yeah, but our class was pretty non-interested. We had a 35th reunion, and no one ever seemed to be terribly interested in doing another one, so if it happens, I'll be there.
Okay. Now, tell us about the
55th
reunion.
Yeah, you just heard Lynn's comments about the probability of having a 50th myself. The first one I attended, my reunion, was my 50th, and I had not remained in contact with my classmates after I left Concord, after getting out of college. I left Concord in 1949 and never lived there again. I moved around in different parts of the country. And didn't maintain contact. Anyways, I decided to attend the 50th with some question as to whether I'd have anything of common interest with my classmates, and found that just being back in Concord and seeing my classmates was something I enjoyed very much. In fact, the group enjoyed it enough at the 50th, so we decided to have a mini reunion on the 51st. And then, the winter prior to the 55th, which was June of 1998, I was exchanging cards for the holidays with some of my classmates, and several have mentioned that there'd been no word about a 55th reunion. So I called one of my classmates, and I said, well, people have been doing it, I'm probably tired of doing it. Unless somebody steps up, I don't think it's going to happen. So John Gallagher and I, John Richard, Stratford, Connecticut, decided that we would run it, and we did. It took place in late June of this year. I think there were 29 classmates who were guests. We had about 39 people.
That's very, very nice. One of the things that people really seem to want in terms of the sense of belonging is having a hometown, and Concord was your hometown.
I had that feeling very much.
And I'm
absolutely
glad that you were able to come back.
No, me too. It was absolutely, if you ask me where I'm from today, I'd probably still say Concord. Mm-hmm. And even though I'm a New Yorker, by all other sides.
Renee, just a few events that maybe you've addressed that I recall which were important to see living in Concord. April 19th parade is always something everybody looked forward to. We've got a bus over. I also have a memory of Friday evening band concerts in the center of town during the summer months. High school sports is something that attracted a lot of people. Lenny was one of the track team athletes. I was the manager of the basketball team for one year. I also remember that there was never was a movie in town when we lived there, and that during the war, there were movies shown in the Veterans Hall on Walden Street on Friday and Saturday nights.
Yes, and that is just a fond memory for a lot of people. Now you know it's like a performing arts.
Yep, performing arts center, yeah.
So that's a great use of is there anything else that you'd like to
add? I just mentioned some of the places that I have some fond memories of. Lake Walden, where I learned to swim. White's Pond, where friends belonged, and I used to swim, which was even more fun. A place that was called Fairyland at the time.
Mm-hmm. The town park.
And that was a place we used to skate in the wintertime. We also used skate on the meadows that flooded, the river flooded there in the fall. And I have very fond memories of the Concord Public Library. We spent a lot of time there, and when we were in town, we tried to visit the museum today.
Well, your change in transcripts will be in the Concord Public Library.
By the way, Fairyland was also a source of the best blueberries the world has ever seen. We would go off and pick blueberries, and Mom would make blueberry pie.
And that memory stayed with you all these years.
I have never tasted a blueberry pie of its light since. And I've faced it, unfortunately, looking at my girth, too many.
Well, those are great memories, and I thank you for sharing them with us.
You're very welcome.
You're welcome. Renee, one of these days, if you do get to New York, I hope you'll let us know in advance.
We'll buy you a drink.
We'd like to meet you.
Well, I certainly look forward to meeting you. I presume the recording is off now?
No. Shall I kill it?
Yeah.
You got it.